thank you for the invitation. So it's my first time in Perimeter. So I'll be talking about this my work with Rajamani Narayanan at Florida International University, where we started looking at these three-dimensional, from now on I'll use the word three-dimension, even though I say 2 plus 1 dimension, I always mean three Euclidean dimensions, with Rajamani Narayanan. And our interest was more on understanding QCD to begin with, whether we have, by studying three dimensions, can we understand something about four dimensions. But along the way, a lot of developments had happened, like a lot of duality conjectures and so on. So it became more ongoing work. So I'll collect all the results over these years into, and then try to go as much as I can as time permits. So this is the plan of my talks. First, I'll just introduce why I do what we do, and then I'll give you an introduction on how to actually study three-dimensional fermionic systems in three dimensions, so that you satisfy all the properties that you require in the continuum. So I hope one of the point of this talk is that you understand that whatever you talk about in the continuum, it is always possible to translate it to a lattice, and there is a rigorous lattice framework, there is gauge invariant, in which you can translate every statement in the continuum to a lattice statement. So I hope that I try to convince you at the end of it. And after I introduce the formalism on the lattice, I'll tell you more on the results using applying this method to more on parity invariant QED3 and QCD and large N theories. And then I'll talk more on this more recent work on actually computing monopole scaling dimensions ab initio calculations, not through some mapping to another local operator. And I'll talk more on this. And then if the time permits, I'll talk about some exploratory works on this N equals 1 QED3, which is of interest to, for example, fractional quantum Hall effect and so on. Yeah, so our interest is basically the following. Any QFT is just a RG flow starting from the vicinity of some UV fixed point and flow onto either a mass gap phase, like for example QCD, which has a particle spectrum of hadrons, or it could flow to another infrared fixed point. So to characterize these systems and try to understand what is the difference between these two systems was our motivation. So let me take a precise way to define the quantum field theory, as I would do. Like when I say quantum field theory, I have a well-defined UV limit where the continuum limit is always at the trivial Gaussian fixed point. That's the fixed point to which we will take the lattice field theory to and take the continuum limit and obtain a well-defined quantum field theory. And once you have obtained the quantum field theory at this fixed point, we ask for what happens to long-distance behaviors of different correlators. This is the infrared behavior that we are interested in, and ask if this infrared behavior is either mass-gapped or is it an infrared fixed point behavior. In the large NF fixed point, for example, in QED3, it's rigorously known that there is an infrared fixed point in three dimensions. So there is a flow from the UV fixed point to a large NF fixed point. And when you lower this fixed point, when you lower the number of flavors NF, it is possible that some operator which remained irrelevant in the infrared but breaks the symmetry becomes relevant, and it flows to possibly another infrared fixed point one. And even if you lower it further, maybe another operator becomes relevant and possibly flows to another infrared fixed point. And finally, it's possible that it doesn't flow to a fixed point anymore and it develops a mass gap. So these kind of behaviors have been of interest to both condensed matter and high energy theory communities of late. So to make it rigorous, what this means is that if there's a parameter like N, which in our case is the number of massless fermion flavors, you could divide it into two different behaviors in the phase diagram of this number of flavors. For large number of flavors, you expect that these correlator of two different observables or the operators, it would have a power law behavior in the limit of large X limit. So to insist again, I'm taking the limit at the UV fixed point, and then I'm only asking if there is a scale invariant behavior in the infrared. So it's not that I'm sitting at a fixed point and asking if there are there is a scale invariant behavior. In that case, you would see correlation, like scaling behavior at all values of distances. But in this case, it's only in the limit of large x, the separation between the correlator, between the operator insertions, that you would expect a power law behavior. And if you lower this number of flavors beyond certain critical flavor n, a star or something, this correlator will, all these correlators will start developing some exponential fall off, and this coefficient of exponential fall off is nothing but the mass, is nothing but the lowest particle associated with this quantum number of the operator. So this operator could be, for example, trivial composites of fields in the quantum field theory itself, for example, such as a vector operator, which we will study later on, or it could be some exotic apparently non-local defects which behave like a local operator, like, for example, this monopole operator in a U1 theory with a U1 symmetry. So there are, so this study of this is characterizing the space of CFTs in three dimensions is also taking a different branch recently because of this non-perturbative conformal bootstrap, which has, for example, has been extremely successful in computing very accurate determinations of these scaling exponents, for example, in this easing CFT from a plot taken from this representative paper. But this is not what I mean when I say numerical. I will be using the much more classical non-perturbative lattice simulations, Monte Carlo simulations, to study things numerically. So that's what I mean by numerical in my title. So another motivation is the recent developments on the particle vortex dualities. So to take an example, which is much more long back from Peskin, is this duality mapping between this XY model and this frozen superconductor model, which is the inverse XY universality class. So this XY corresponds to E equal to zero, and this inverse XY corresponds to T equal to zero limit. And what Peskin showed exactly was that this charges at this point get mapped onto monopoles in the inverse XY. So this is one of the earliest examples of this particle vortex dualities. And there have been a lot of modern developments in this direction, which are more on the basis of conjectures. The last one was more on mathematical proof, whereas these are, even though there are well-motivated reasons to expect these dualities, it is still at the level of conjectures. And for example, in this paper, for example, in Chong Wang et al. And Kashim Tong, they start from a seed duality, and they go on to show that it leads to a lot of dualities. For example, one might be interested in studying this system to begin with and show that it's true or not. So one of the questions is, can we use lattice to study these systems? Prove or disprove, it would be a numerical proof, but nevertheless, it would be a good direction to take. So these are, this is one reason I am interested in this. So now that I have motivated you enough, let me move on to the formalism part of this. So in this part, I'll tell you more on this lattice regularization of the fermion itself. So this is, take a concrete example, let me take QED. So this is the Lagrangian of QED in three dimensions. So this part is the fermionic part, which has n, capital N, flavors of two-component fermions. These psi are two-component fermionic fields, and sigmas are the 2x2 Pauli matrices. This part here is the gauge action gives the gauge action. And unlike in four dimensions where the coupling is dimensionless, here it has dimension of mass. So setting of scale is pretty simple in three dimensions. So all you have to do is set g square equals one and measure everything in units of g square. In four dimensions, it's a very tricky business, but in here in three dimensions, it makes it my life much easier. And in fact, it makes this theory super normalizable. So this part here is what is the massless Dirac operator, and Q is the charge. A special property in three dimensions in this naive, of this continuum operator is this anti-hermeticity of the Dirac operator, which is important when we talk about this parity anomaly. So this gauge part could be either compact or non-compact. So I don't want to confuse it by saying that non-compact doesn't mean the gauge group is real, but instead, both these theories are U1 gauge theories. except that when I say compact, it means that the monopoles are allowed in the when you do this path integral, and non-compact means that monopoles are not allowed in the path integral in the continuum limit. So how do you, so just a brief primer on lattice field theory is that you take the space, Euclidean space-time, and you discretize this, okay. You take a Euclidean space-time of extents, physical extents little l in all three directions. It could have been three different in case, but in my case, for simplicity, I take it to be the same in all three directions. So L is the physical length of the box. And you can talk, and this is measured in units of G square. So this is a dimensionless length of the box in units of G square. And you discretize this physical length L into capital L cube lattice sites. So because this theory is super renormalizable, the continuum limit is very simple. You want to keep the little L fixed, and then you keep increasing the value of capital L, and you take the capital L tends to infinite limit at fixed value of little L. That defines for you a continuum limit at the Gaussian fixed point. So this is what I will be talking about in the continuum limit, and this has to be taken before you study anything else. So to come back to the aspect of compact or non-compact, this QED, to make it more concrete, this is what I mean. So this is the partition function for QED, written again. So here, it's a path integral over these lattice gauge fields, which I mean theta, and you have this, you so integrate over the fermions and make it into a fermion determinant here. So it becomes a determinant of n by 2 power, because, and then there are factors of d dagger times d, and d is the some regulated lattice Dirac operator. So these lattice Dirac operators are always functions of the compact variable e raised to I theta. So theta to theta plus 2 pi n is a symmetry. And for the gauge field, let's just call it W of G. And this part also satisfies the compactness theta to theta plus 2 pi n of the U1 gauge group. So one way of writing it is the Villain form of this gauge part, which is summed over some integer valued configurations of n mu nu times this usual Maxwell term, except that it's coupled to some this integer valued background field. And depending on what values of n mu nu that you allow, you call it compact or non-compact. So in compact QED, what you do is you allow every possible value of n mu nu, which means that this this curl of n is zero generically at all values of n. So there are monopoles and anti-monopoles everywhere. So this is what is called compact QED. So it's equivalent to saying you're putting a Wilson action if you know what is the lattice theory language. The non-compact QED means you restrict this sum over n only to those n which satisfy this curl of n as zero at all values of x. So that's equivalent to integrating theta over minus infinity plus infinity. It is the usual e raised to minus f square action. So in this constraint, monopoles are not allowed because you cannot have fluxes of 2 pi in one plucket in the continuum limit. And you can generalize it to a non-compact QED with a monopole insertion and monopole anti-monopole insertion, a monopole at point x and a monopole and anti-monopole at point x prime by restricting your path integral to these values of n mu nu, which is so that the curl of n is has a 2q at point x and minus 2q at point x prime. So this is equivalent to putting a monopole operator at point x zero and an anti-monopole operator at point x prime.
Go back to the things. Sure. You mentioned here the reason you can take this continuum limit is because of the super-regularizability.
No, because for example, let's take QED. Sorry, not QED. Four-dimensional QCD. There are no mass parameters in your theory to begin with. So there, if you want to study the continuum limit, what you want to do is you want to keep ratios of things constant. Or like say the proton mass is this value and the pion mass is something. So you choose your bare parameters in for every lattice spacing or the beta or the lattice spacing that you simulate. You need to choose your bare parameters in such a way that you reproduce certain n parameters of the theory, which are basically two parameters in QCD with two flavors. So once you have done this, scale setting, you can predict every other value because of the renormalization. Whereas in three dimensions, it's much simpler because you don't have to equate to, you don't have to say proton is this mass or the pion is this mass. All you have to do is say, I'm putting the system in a box size of L and I'm going to keep increasing the number of lattice points at fixed little L. And G squared measures little L for you. So it's simpler. That's where the super renormalizability enters.
These are just for the case where the fermions are massless?
For every theory. For fermion mass has this, the usual scaling. So you just, you keep changing the lattice mass, decrease it by lattice unit, by the factor in which you decrease it by. So it's simple. So you just, every operator have the naive dimensions at the Gaussian fixed point. So you just scale the lattice operators by appropriate powers of the naive dimension. Yeah. So this with this, I have told you what QED, U1 non-compact and compact QED are, and what the monopole insertion means. Now, another nitty-gritty of this three-dimensional system is the parity anomaly. The point is that this D is trivial, is anti-Hermitian in a trivial sense, just at the operator level. But once you regulate it, the phase determinant of D slash after UV regularization develops a non-trivial phase, which is a function of A. So that's even in the limit of, okay, sorry, let me go back. In three dimensions, mass breaks parity. So in the massless limit, there is an exact parity symmetry in the Lagrangian. But once you regulate it, even in the massless case, the determinant of D slash has a non-trivial phase. So let me study. So you can ask what happens to the phase as a function of mass. In one sense, so once you regulate it, this is what happens. So in the mass equals plus infinity limit, this phase of the determinant becomes a q squared times an eta invariant, which is nothing but, which is like the q squared by 4 pi times this Chern-Simons term. In the massless limit, m equal to 0, this gamma becomes the half the eta invariant, which is like the half, which is roughly speaking the half the Chern-Simons term. So this is nothing but the parity anomaly, because naively this shouldn't exist. And in this regulation, with this choice of regularization, in the m tends to minus infinity, there is no anomaly. So any lattice regularization that you use has to reproduce these effects so that it's correct. Yeah.
Do you fix the number of the fermions, or what's the
number of fermions is fixed? I mean, you can, that's a variable, but yeah. But you can change it. That's the number of fermion players. N is the number of two component fermion.
Flavor of the fermions.
Number of fermion flavors.
Number of the fermions.
Two component fermion flavors.
Okay, but that doesn't scale up with your system size.
No, and it's not the number of fermions. It's the number of flavors of fermions.
The flavor of the fermions. Right. But I'm asking, but do you fix finite density of fermions, or do you just finite?
No, fermions have, this is the exact fermion path integral, which is determinant of D slash. That's it. There is no path integral that you do over fermions. It's the path integral is done, so you just put that in the measure. And only integrate over the gauge fields with this as part of the measure. So this sums over every possible fermion number in your Fock space. And
I see, so it's effectively, in average, half filling.
Yeah, it's all automatic, and I mean it's.
There's some CT symmetry that guarantees it.
Also, it's like a grand canonical ensemble in terms of fermion number, but in average you put half filling. I see.
Okay. So with this, because of this behavior with mass, you can study, there are many ways to do it, but let's, for this talk, we can consider two different ways you can construct a parity invariant theory. One is what I will call a trivially parity invariant theory, is to consider two exactly massless charge one fermions, each of them contributing an anomaly of half the eta invariant. And to that, you add one Pauli-Villars regulator with a charge one fermion, which contributes an anomaly of minus eta invariant. So the total anomaly is zero. So this is one case. This is what has been studied from over the last 30 years or so. It is like a vector gauge theory when you talk about four dimensions. The other theory, which has been quite of focus recently, is because of its relevance to fractional quantum Hall effect. The one variant of that is that it's one massless Q equals charge 2 fermion, which contributes an anomaly of 2 eta, because it's and then you have a 2 polyvillars regulator, each of them having a charge of Q equals 1, so each of them having an eta invariant of minus eta. So the total anomaly is still 0. So in the continuum sense, this is the theory. So you have a charge 2 fermion, and to that you add a level 2 Chern-Simons term. So that's what this means. And this, for example, has been conjectured to be equivalent to a free fermion theory. So can we study these things on the lattice? So this is the two parity invariant theories. I will be talking about this theory mainly, and if time permits in the last part, I'll talk about something I've done about this. So coming to the lattice regulator, so here's, without proof, I'm just telling you how it works out on the lattice. On the lattice, so you have a formalism called the overlap fermion formalism, which guarantees to you that the fermions are exactly massless even on the lattice, even at any finite lattice spacing. So for this overlap formalism, it has been shown that this generating function for the overlap fermion psi, with this fermion species psi bar and psi is this value. It's the determinant of 1 minus the lattice mass of the fermion plus another term where involving 2L cubed by 2L cubed unitary matrix, which I call the V of QA. This can be constructed out of Wilson-Dirac operator and so on, but we don't have to go into that. All you have to know is that there exists a unitary matrix VQ of A on the lattice, and that gives you the fermion measure on the integrated fermion determinant of D slash on the lattice. And this is a exactly unitary matrix. So now the anomaly that I've been talking about is quite apparent here. So let's take the lattice mass equals 1. When you take lattice mass equals 1, it means that the physical mass is 1 by the cutoff, which is nothing but the infinite mass behavior. It's like a polyvillars term. So so this reduces to a determinant of a unitary matrix, which is nothing but a phase. And this phase is nothing but the eta invariant. So what you can do is you can do this computation on different smooth backgrounds and actually check that this matches quite well with what you expect from a Chern-Simons term for that particular background field. So here's a way to actually introduce Chern-Simons term, which is exactly gauge invariant on the lattice, and that is realized as an infinitely massive induced action from an infinitely massive overlap fermion.
Sorry, just make sure I understand. So VQA is known. There's nothing to tune there.
VQA is some operator. There's nothing to tune. It's in terms of the Wilson-Dirac operator. There are no free parameters anymore. And you take the other limit, m lattice mass to 0, which is nothing but physical mass to 0, you have the determinant of 1 plus the unitary operator. And that's nothing but is nothing but the half square root of this, which is like the half the Chern-Simons, up to some positive plus or minus terms. So this nicely reproduces all the statements that I've told you in the continuum. This one? That's just the propagator. This is a generating function. You take derivatives, you can produce endpoints. So G is the fermion propagator in this. It's 1 minus V by 1 plus V.
So the left hand side is not the full partition function?
So this is the partition function. So it's a generating function for the fermion. So without this term, this is the fermion determinant. So coming back to this statement in the continuum, how will you realize these two systems on the lattice? So you want to do this thing. So what you want to do is for this first term in the bracket, you will put 2 Q equals 1 fermions, massless fermions. So that means putting determinant of 1 plus V square. And for this 1 polyvillars with Q equals 1 anomaly, you would put a determinant of V dagger A. So that means it's determinant of 1 plus v times 1 plus v dagger. So it's exactly parity invariant, even at any finite lattice spacing. So there is no anomaly in the system, even at finite lattice spacing. And that's why I said this is like a chiral gauge, not a vector gauge theory in 4 dimensions. There you have, like, yeah.
Oh, there's an amplitude, presumably. So the determinant 1 plus v a part.
It's 1/2 factors.
No, I mean the overall amplitude. Presumably that.
It's 1 plus 2.
That's the absolute value of the determinant.
Sorry, which one? I didn't get it.
Sorry, the right lower corner. The lower right corner.
This one? No,
Yeah, but so the. Can I understand the amplitude of that determinant y plus va as the absolute value of the determinant of the Dirac operator? Is that how I interpret the thing?
No, just do every yeah. So it's up to some plus or minus factor. So it's each of them have an eigenvalue e raised to I phi. So it's e to the I sum over all the faces, eigen faces,
sure.
And this becomes one plus. Product over 1 plus e to the I eigenfaces.
The reason I'm asking is at the massless point, the party function doesn't just have the e eigenvector. There's the mod part.
So it's not exactly equal to square root of this. It's the square root of this up to plus or minus factors.
Okay.
That comes because it can wind around and so on.
Okay.
There can be trivial factors of I pi. I n pi. So this theory has exact parity invariance on the lattice, even on the lattice. Yeah.
So you have some different choices of the VQ such that sometimes you get a plus, sometimes you get a minus. For fixed the VQ, shouldn't you get a fixed answer?
Yes.
So you mean you have different choices of VQ, such that sometimes you get plus e to the I eta over 2, sometimes you get minus e to the I.
Isn't it the same as saying choosing a choice here? Like you can say it's 0 here and...
Yeah, I think it is.
Yeah, so it's... So that is exactly, that is like saying instead of choosing V, we choose V dagger. That's equivalent. Yeah.
But V and V dagger, there's no tuning. If I consider the pair of V and V dagger, then there's no tuning function.
Yeah. So that's the first theory here. Like if you, that is like putting one is regulated with the V, another is regulated with the V dagger, and then there is exact anomaly cancellation. There's no more choice anymore. So this has been studied for a while. And the next theory, this theory two, which is also parity invariant in the continuum, is realized like this. So you would put a 1 plus V coupled to twice the gauge field in this part because of charge 2. And to that, you would add 2 Pauli-Villars term with charge 1 and square it. So, but unlike this case, on the lattice, you cannot show that this is parity invariant. It has a non-trivial face at any finite lattice spacing. So this is like a chiral gauge theory in 4 dimensions, where you know in standard model there is no chiral anomaly in perturbation theory, even to what, because it's one loop exact. But if you, when you try to do it on the lattice, it's an unsolved problem. How do you study standard model, the chiral, the weak sector of the standard model on the lattice, because the chiral anomaly doesn't exactly cancel on the lattice. So this is a system which is quite reminiscent of that in 3 dimensions. So what you should show is, it's what we studied is to study this at every finite lattice spacing and show that the continuum limit, the face exactly cancels off it, but any finite lattice spacing, you find a distribution of faces. So first, let me go study theory one here. So in this theories, it has been of interest to over the last 30 years. Yeah.
The phenomena you just mentioned, that the chiral anomaly does not exist in the continuum, but on the lattice it seems to exist. Is it related to non-symmetry breaking by the lattice?
It's just a, no, it's because it doesn't have the symmetry. It's the regulator is such that it's not invariant under the symmetry. And it's, yeah, there is no known way of studying, putting a lattice, choosing a regulator so that it's exactly preserving the symmetry at every finite lattice piece. Yeah, so this theory, which is parity, yeah.
But is it known whether there's any mixed anomaly between Lorentz symmetry and whatever symmetry associated with Kylo anomaly?
I don't think so. I'm not sure. I mean, it has to be, everything has to be proportional to some order A effect, and the corresponding terms will be some irrelevant operator. But those things are non-vanishing at every finite lattice space. Even if you use a lattice regulator, which is supposed to be exactly massless at finite lattice space. Yeah, okay. So this theory where you have n flavors of two-component fermions has a n to SUN flavor symmetry because of this, has a SUN flavor symmetry. And the scale breaking in this theory could come about because of this breaking of this SUN flavor symmetry into SUN by 2 times SUN by 2. Which is due to the condensate here, which is flavor isovector condensate, which is of this form where n by 2 of the species get a wave here, and n by 2 of the other species of fermions have the opposite, so that this whole thing is isospin symmetric. This was studied for a long time, starting with Rob Pizarski and Wafa and Witten. They showed that the other isospin symmetric condensate, a development of that has higher free energy than this, and therefore, what all you have to do is just look for whether this condensate is present or not. You don't have to go and check the other condensate is present. If this condensate is present, then it's a scale even in the limit of infinite box size, which is a trivial scale in the system. Which is like, there is a trivial scale G square in the system, but this would set a scale even in the finite box size tending to infinite. So generalizing it to a plane of number of fermion flavors versus the number of colors of the gauge group, where I have misused a notation to say that NC equals 1 is QED, which is not, so that saves space. So this line here is QED, and this line here is number of colors. So what you would expect is a line like this, where is a critical number of flavors, which is NC dependent, above which it's scale invariant, and below which it's scale broken. And studying this line would be quite interesting. And so that's some step we have taken. That's what I will tell you about now. So how would you actually go about saying whether the infrared of a quantum field theory, fermionic quantum field theory, has a scale or not? And this has been quite well addressed for QCD. And so what we did was to take that whole framework down to this 2+1 dimensions. So all you have to do is the following. So you study the theory at finite values of finite box size. So the spectrum of the Dirac operator is discrete in a finite box size. So you can ask a well-defined question: what is the continuum limit of each of these levels, and first eigenvalue, second eigenvalue, and third one? These are called the microscopic eigenvalues. So you study these, so obtain these low-lying eigenvalues of the Dirac operator, and just arrange them in according to their magnitude. So it's the first eigenvalue, second eigenvalue, and so on. That's what I mean by that. And then once you have it at every finite lattice spacing, you can take the continuum limit of each of these eigenvalues. That is to take capital L to infinite, number of lattice points to infinite, at fixed value of little l. And once you have this continuum values of lambda of L, you can ask how do these low-lying eigenvalues scale with the box size, and that has information on the infrared behavior. So there are three scenarios that one can think of. One is the trivial free theory. In free theory, because lambda has dimensions of mass, it just shows a trivial one by the length of the box scaling, because these are plane waves. in free theory. So this is the free theory behavior. And the next behavior would be, let me move on to the second system, which would be scale invariant, which is a non-trivial fixed point. Because it's dimension of mass, you would expect that it obtains a dimension, mass anomalous dimension gamma n. And you would expect to see a scaling of lambda, which is 1 by L1 plus the mass scaling anomalous dimension in this fixed point, if there is a fixed point. The other scenario is the mass, if the infrared develops a condensate. In that case, because of the Banks-Cascher relation that the density of Dirac spectrum has a non-zero value at lambda equal to zero, you expect that this eigenvalue scale one by the volume of the box size. So that is observation one. So first step is to check that there is a one by volume scaling of the eigenvalues. And once you have that, this coefficient that connects the lambda to the one by volume scaling can actually be obtained from a random matrix theory, which has all the same symmetries as that of your theory, microscopic theory that you're studying, QED or SU2 theory and so on. So ZI, so I'll explain more on that. So one of the coefficient that connects the lambda to the one by volume scaling is nothing but the condensate value of the condensate itself. So this gives us two things. One is if the theory is conformal, it gives a way of obtaining the mass anomalous dimension. So, and the other thing is to say whether the theory has a condensate by checking whether there's one by volume. And if you do see a one by volume, you can actually obtain the value of the condensate itself from the finite volume scaling.
So if the anomalous dimension is 2, how do you distinguish the scale?
2 is basically, if there is 2, then it's condensate. It means that there is a non-zero intercept of this density of eigenvalues, which means that there is a condensate by definition.
So this is not directly the anomalous dimension.
So you can say gamma equals 2 is the anomalous dimension, but you wouldn't call that anomalous dimension, gamma minus 2. Yeah. Okay, so going back to, let me explain this part a little more, what the ZI and sigma mean. So the reason for this expectation that you can actually have a correspondence with a random matrix theory is the following. If there is a, let's say there is a symmetry breaking, then there is a Goldstone boson in this theory. And because you're studying this theory on a finite box size, and the box size is much larger, smaller than the Compton wavelength of the pion or the Goldstone boson, then the spatial fluctuations of the pion field are unimportant. But rather, what is important is a fluctuation in the field itself. So this problem of studying the system, chirally symmetric broken system on a finite box reduces to a study of a matrix model, just the fluctuations of the pion field. And in these limits, the length of the box is much smaller than the Compton wavelength, and length of the box is larger than the typical Hadron scale in the system, if there is a Hadron scale. Leutweiler, Smilga et al., they have shown that this reduces to a matrix problem, so it's not just words. So, and similarly, what they have also shown is that this distribution of eigenvalues of the Dirac spectrum, distribution of the eigenvalues of the D, are exactly distributed in the same way as the eigenvalues of the corresponding random matrix theory are distributed. So this is on the right-hand side is that particular random matrix theory for QED with n flavors, which has all the symmetries as that of QED. So this path matrix integral is an integral over, for QED, it becomes an integral over a Hermitian set matrices, which you typically called a GUE ensemble in the absence of this determinant. And the presence of fermion, you have this factor determinant of n by 2 to reproduce this behavior. And this is called a non-chiral Gaussian unitary ensemble. So the distribution of this is exactly the same as distribution of this on a small enough box sizes, if there is a chiral condensate. For SU2 theory, because it's not SU2, but rather it's basically SPN symmetry. This H is no longer Hermitian, but instead it's a real symmetric matrices in this case. That's the only nitty-gritty here, but all these things are true. So one way to check it is look at the distribution of the eigenvalues and see if it is looking similar to each of the eigenvalue distribution of the random matrix theory, each of these random matrix theories. So n should be the same as the n here. And once you have it, you can define, for example, a L-dependent chiral condensate, which is defined here, which is sigma of I means it is obtained from the ith eigenvalue, and define it to be Zi, which is the corresponding eigenvalue of this random matrix theory, divided by L cube, divided by the eigenvalue of the Dirac operator. So this is the definition of this little l. So the statement is the following. So if there is a chiral condensate, all this framework works, whatever I've explained to you before. If that is true, this limit has to exist. This little l tends to infinite. This value sigma I of L has to approach a non-zero value sigma. And not only that, this value has to be independent of which eigenvalue that you use to get that from. It cannot be different between the first eigenvalue, second eigenvalue, third eigenvalue. They all have to get the same eigenvalue, same value for sigma in the infinite L limit. Or the other scenario is this whole definition is wrong because you used a framework which assumed a chiral symmetry breaking. And what in that case, what you would see is this quantity simply vanishes as L to the minus 2 plus the mass anomalous dimension. So this is a framework to test whether the theory is IR scale invariant or not, and what's the value of the condensate. So this is the process. A typical example is the following. This is a result taken from n equals 2 QED done with overlap fermion. So what this plot, let me just look at the left panel. So it plots the first eigenvalue of the Dirac operator multiplied by the length, which is a dimensionless quantity, as a function of 1 by the box size square. For overlap fermion, the first correction is order 1 by L square. So what you see, each of these points corresponds to five different values of capital L at a fixed value of little l, shown here on here. So you keep little l equals 128, simulate all these values of capital L, and that's the line. And then you try to extrapolate to capital L tends to infinite limit. So that is an estimation, that's an extrapolation that you have to live with. And that gives you an estimate of the continuum limit of this quantity. So once you have done that, you have removed lattice for all practical purposes. Now you have a continuum quantum field theory statements. So one check to do it is the following. Oh, is that you might like, maybe your continuum limits are a bit wrong, or I don't know, because I cannot justify it. One way to justify, I can try to justify, is to do two different ways of regulating it on the same lattice. One is to use, for example, a regulator called Wilson fermion, the Dirac fermion, which is one way to do it. And another is the overlap fermion, which I explained to you. They are two different things at any finite lattice spacing. Only the continuum limit, they are universally the same. So I've shown the log of this quantity as a function of log L. And each color corresponds to lambda 1, lambda 2, lambda 3. And the open symbols are from the Wilson fermion, continuum limit obtained through simulations to the Wilson fermion. And the filled ones are obtained in the continuum limit using overlap fermion. As you can see, at any finite lattice spacing, what you see is a huge discrepancy. But once you have taken the continuum limit for these two cases, you see a good enough agreement between these two two different lattice operators. So perhaps what we are doing is OK, as far as we can say. So continuum limit, I think, is fine.
Sorry, Tom?
Yeah.
To check whether I have the chiral condensate or not, why can't I just directly measure the collision?
You can just measure the quantity psi bar psi. But that's a very difficult quantity to do because it has a lot of UV divergences to begin with. So it's not very numeric. It's a very ill-defined quantity on the lattice.
What about measuring the correlation function?
You want to measure the disconnected correlators,
yeah.
But that's a difficult quantity. But this gives those have been done. People have tried to do that. Okay. Another thing is like the condensate at any value of mass is zero, right? To begin with, if you put the mass equals zero, the condensate is zero. If you just measure using the procedure that you're telling me,
okay.
Right? So first, what you have to do is put a finite value of mass, take the thermodynamic limit at that particular value of mass, and then study m to zero limit.
Yeah.
That's a much more laborious thing to do. There are a lot of uncertainties. Like first, you need to find an infinite volume limit. That's an extrapolation. Then you need to take the m to zero limit. That's again an extrapolation. To avoid this, you can study the theory at precisely m equal to zero, and that itself contains enough information about the finite size, about the condensate. And now, through this, you're avoiding the m to zero extrapolation. So all you have to do is look at the finite size scaling itself. So with this thing, we can, as a consistency check, we can study the areas where you expect the symmetry to be broken. And these are the areas of the space diagram. One is the n equal to zero, which is hard to say, but you can realize it on the lattice, which is basically you are doing, it's called the quenched calculation, if you have heard of the lattice framework. So you generate configurations, gauge fields, just using the pure gauge part. But on this gauge field, you use the fermions as spectators, as some probe of the degrees of freedom, of the gauge field. And because this gauge field anyway has a scale to begin with, you expect a condensate when you probe it using a external fermion. So you expect the quenched case to have a condensate. And the other case is the large NC limit, when the fermion loops are unimportant to the whole, it's unimportant corresponding to the gauge field itself. So along this part, you expect the condensate to develop. And this is the thing that we check to begin with. So here is I'm showing the result for the quenched U1 theory, which is just pure U1 theory, on which you are measuring the Dirac spectrum on top of it. So there is no back reaction from the fermion in this theory. So these points here are the first, second, third, and fourth eigenvalues of the Dirac operator, the distribution of them. So these points are actually the Dirac operator spectrum, whereas these lines here are from the corresponding random matrix theory corresponding to that. That's basically without the determinant of the fermion, just e raised to minus Hermitian matrix square. So that's the corresponding prediction. So as you see that the agreement is quite well. So it says that it agrees with random matrix theory as expected, which means that there is a condensate. And through this relation that sigma sees this definition, you can actually get the condensate itself. So what I plot here is the sigma I, this quantity, as a function of 1 by little l, and different colors are corresponding to different values of the I, which is basically first, second, third eigenvalues. At any finite little l, they give different values as expected, because you don't expect them to be the same at any finite volume. But in the infinite volume limit, if you extrapolate them, they all get to the same value. And the value is around 10 to the minus 4-ish. So even in quenched theory, it's a pretty tiny number corresponding to the value of g squared. So in quenched theory, it works, this method. The other thing is the Tuhoff limit, which is basically you study different values of colors of fermions. So in this case, I've shown the result for NC equals 47. So again, the notation is the same. It's the first, second, third, fourth, fifth eigenvalues. The lines are the expectation from the random matrix theory. Again, agreement is quite well seen. Here I see the extrapolation. In this case, it's not an extrapolation in volume, but rather in this case, it's an extrapolation in the number of colors. It's because the color is now the corresponding volume. And in the infinite volume, infinite color limit, you see that they all tend to the same condensate. So again, in the Tuhoff limit, it works. Now we can take this and ask what happens when there is an actual back reaction from the fermion. And in this QED3, we ask what happens for n equals 2, 4, and so on. So this is the case for QED3 with n equals 2 fermion, which is the smallest number of flavors, which is parity invariant on the lattice. So here, the same histogram. This line here is the corresponding GUE, corresponding random matrix theory, whereas these points here are the actual distribution of the Dirac spectrum. You see that even when you go to really large volumes, physical volumes, you see there is no tendency of this to start agreeing with the corresponding random matrix theory. The quenched theory I showed you, there was a bang on agreement with random matrix theory. Here, there is no tendency at all. And it seems to saturate this kind of distributions. Yeah. So
I really stare at, doesn't it look like as your system size grows larger, it becomes more like?
No, but if you look at these 112 foot, because it's 48, but if you look at these three things, it's very little movement. I mean, it's possible that if L equals 10,000 or something, it's moving extremely slowly, and it's possible, but it's it looks pretty unlikely that it's happening. Or you can plot this quantity, which I define, the same thing here from four different eigenvalues extrapolated to one by L. Sorry, the x-axis is one by L, little l. When you just do a naive extrapolation in one by L square, and so on, it just goes on to zero. It's consistent with zero, but the error bars is about 10 to the minus 7. So what I can say is, at the level of 10 to the minus 7, there is no condensate. If you say there is a 10 to the minus 20 condensate, I have no idea how to. I don't think anybody is going to tell you if they're going to find it anytime soon. So probabilistically speaking, it's very unlikely. Probabilistically speaking, I can ask another question. Assuming there is no condensate, let's say it's a conformal field theory in the infrared. So we can ask, what is the most likely value of the scaling dimension gamma n? So I'm not asking that sigma is a non-zero number, but rather I say it vanishes like this in the little l tends to infinite limit. And then I ask, if this is the functional form which behaves the leading behavior with some 1 by L square corrections on top of it, what is the expected value of a mass scaling dimension? So that's what I show here of this gamma m. Gamma m is nothing but the log derivative of this quantity, which purely scaling will give you just a single number. So these are from n equals 2 QED. These are from four different eigenvalues again. So it starts flowing with little l because it's not still in the infrared region. So what this dashed line shows is the largest value of little l where we actually have the data. So this is like an interpolation, sorry. And beyond that is an extrapolation. So what you have is beyond that, it goes to a scaling dimension, anomalous dimension of about 1 or 1.5. And also all these four eigenvalues seem to give the same value. So it seems very likely that QED3 with two flavors has a pretty comparatively large anomalous dimension, about 1, compared to the likelihood of QED3 having a small enough condensate. So these are two possibilities. And so we can, once you don't find a condensate for n equals to 2, it's very highly unlikely that it's going to develop a condensate at higher value of n. So these are the finite size dependence of the lambda 1 first eigenvalue times L as a function of log L from four different values of flavors. 2 is what I showed you, 6, 4, and 8. And what I show here is if I try to say what is the most likely value of gamma m from the large distance behavior, this is what I get. This is the A dip means it's very likely that it's the value around here in this plot. That's what it means. So it's about 1 here, 4, it's about 0.75. It goes, for some reason, like 1 by n times some quantity. So that's the status with QED. But we can ask more questions on it based on some conjectures. One of the conjectures, I don't know, it's from your paper, is the self-duality of QED. So in the self-duality, one side of QED, the background field is coupled to the fermion vector current. On the other side of the duality, the background field is coupled to the topological current. And these two theories are supposed to be dual to each other.
I think the earliest paper that talked about this one is by Yeo and Xu.
So a prediction from this duality is that in the infrared, the correlator of this fermion vector current has to be exactly the same as the topological current correlator on the right-hand side, the same QED3. So that's what we checked here. So this line here on the top line is the vector current correlator. So this on the y-axis is the correlator itself as a function of the distance between the insertion of the current J1, 0, and J2 at So that's the distance dependence of the correlator. And this is the fermion vector current correlator here. And that's showing there's no change in the scaling because it's a conserved vector current and it has a dimension 2 all the way from the UV to infrared. Here, this line which is curving here is the topological current correlator. As you see, at small distances, there is no agreement at all between these two correlators. But if you go to much larger values of this separation, you see that it's tending to the vector current correlator.
How do you decide the normalization of this figure?
I mean, because if this is the current, I don't know what's the question. This is the topological current. So as defined here, this operator has to agree with this operator. So there seems to be an agreement in the infrared. Perhaps this duality, maybe there is self-duality as seen from this quantity.
So is it just a statement about scaling dimension of those two operators?
No, it's not that it's just a scaling dimension. It could have been that this curve here approaches this slope, but at a different point. But it's a statement that it's become degenerate with this correlator itself. It's a non-trivial statement. But then we moved on to the SU2 QCD. I'm not going to explain this plot again. So it's the same histogram. There's this, the open symbols are the expectation from the corresponding random matrix theory. The closed symbols are the ones from the from QCD itself. So as you see, for n equals 2, you see a nice agreement between the two. And similarly, if you do this L-dependent condensate and extrapolate to L tends to infinite, all these lines, even though they disagree, they tend to the same value at L tends to infinite. So there is some, I would say, it's fair to say that there is a very nice signal for condensate. But as you see, this was done with a fermion which breaks the flavor symmetry at any finite lattice spacing. But the continuum limit has been taken. But if it is not taken, there are possibilities that it still flows to infrared fixed point. But that can be checked by doing overlap fermion formulation, which is much harder. But this is the status. And we did it for other values of flavors for SU2. And this is the corresponding understanding right now. So for QED, along these two lines, there is definitely condensate. And the Toof limit and the quench theory, the moment you turn on the dynamical flavor, it becomes infrared fixed point, develops in the n equals 2 and remains so at here. And for nc equals 2, it receives a good signal till n equals 4. N equals 4 or 6 between the two, there could be a transition from scale broken to scale invariant phases. So this is the current status of this. Then I quickly move on to this monopole scaling dimension. So if I, can I take 10 minutes? Okay, thanks. Okay, so this is the model that I described to you. So I wanted to see if we can use this numerical technique to study particle vortex dualities in these conjectural cases. Before that, we can take this case where we know for sure that there's particle vortex duality is true because it's analytically proven. So this means studying the XY model, charge-charge correlator in the XY model, which has been studied pretty well. And then on the other limit, study this limit, which is called the frozen superconductor model here, which is the T equal to zero, but a transition as a function of the electric charge. And study the monopole correlator here. So how do you actually study a monopole correlator? Typically, people map this system to some other system where it becomes a local operator and measure that to obtain the scaling dimensions. But here is a straightforward but a pretty laborious way to do that, is to couple the system with a U1 symmetry to a background gauge field from a monopole field and study the free energy on this background field. Because we are studying it on a torus, we cannot put a single monopole on the lattice. So rather, you put a monopole and an anti-monopole, which are separated by some distance, r. So you separate them, put them in a box here. So it's monopole here, anti-monopole, and scale. So study the free energy of the system to which it is coupled to as a function of R. And that would, if it is a CFT in the infrared, you would see the free energy to scale, not scale, to behave, have a logarithmic dependence on the distance between the monopole and anti-monopole. And if you maintain the distance proportional to L, you would see a log times system size dependence. And this coefficient of this logarithmic behavior is nothing but this scaling dimension of the monopole or the monopole operator, the smallest scaling dimension with that particular one member. So basically, it boils down to finding the free energy of the system coupled to a background monopole field, anti-monopole field. That's a pretty, again, it's not a straightforward thing because this means finding that the partition function with monopole to ratioed to another partition function without monopole. So on the top, you have a cis. So this leads to an overlap problem because the part which you introduce the monopole is exponentially small, which is hard to study on a numerical simulation. So you have to find a way to do that. And the solution is pretty straightforward. You just differentiate and then integrate back. So you study to do that. What I mean by that is, you, let's call Z coupled to AQ as the partition function of the system coupled to AQ. But instead of coupling to the full gauge field of the monopole and anti-monopole, couple it to zeta times AQ, where zeta is some auxiliary field that you will change from 0 to 1. And then if you differentiate it, it reduces to this quantity, the differential of the free energy, log z. And that's a quantity which is in a form which is measurable on the lattice, because you can measure this quantity in a Monte Carlo simulation, because it's just some expectation value of some quantity. And that's measurable. So W of zeta is something that you measure on the lattice. And on the lattice, so that for every value of zeta, so you have to simulate multiple values of zeta. So that's the expensive part. And once you have W of zeta, you can integrate from 0 to Q. That will give you the free energy of the system with charge Q, magnetic charge Q monopole. So here's a sample W of zeta as a function of zeta in the case of free fermion. It's basically determinant of fermion coupled to background monopole antimonopole field. And the determinant for the fermion is basically Wilson-Dirac, so it's a lattice operator, lattice Dirac operator. And so these different lines are from different values of capital L. And once you have, so basically you have to integrate this quantity from 0 to Q. So this is the free energy dependence in free fermion theory as a function of capital L for Q equals 1 and Q equals 2. And these lines here and this linear behavior in log L, this gives you the scaling dimension of the monopole with Q equals 1 and Q equals 2. And these agree pretty well with the corresponding analytical calculations of the Casimir free energy of fermions on a sphere with magnetic flux on top of it. So this is just a check, and also says that our Wilson-Dirac fermion formalism, there's nothing wrong, nothing going wrong because of our regularization. Everything agrees. Now going to the system of particle vortex dualities. So here's the result of this free energy of the monopole antimonopole pair in the frozen superconductor model, which is the dual of the XY model, as a function of log L. So you fit these behavior, capital L behavior, for Q equals 1, 2, and 3 monopoles. And so I have tabulated this. This is the monopole scaling dimension as determined from a Monte Carlo simulation. So these are this. And the XY model charge has been done pretty well. And these are done recently by Silesh and collaborators. So here is the corresponding charge Q correlator in XY model. So you see that these are pretty good consistency between these two models. So it's nothing unexpected that I've told you. It's pretty much expected. I would be surprised if it didn't happen. But rather, what I demonstrated to you is this is a method that you can actually apply to particle vortex dualities. Because on the right-hand side, you have some correlator of charge field correlator. On the left-hand side, you want to measure vortex correlator. For that, you do this technique. But what is really problematic is you need to find a system without any sign problem, and that's an issue. Once you find it, I think with this framework, we can actually study these dualities pretty well. And one more thing I studied is the monopole operator scaling dimensions in QED. This is important because in non-compact QED, for large enough flavors, flows to a fixed point, and you expect that compact QED also flows to the same fixed point for large number of flavors. But if you lower the scaling number of flavors, below certain critical value, you expect that the compact QED flows to some mass gap phase, while the compact QED still remains, non-compact QED still remains infrared scale invariant. As I told you, it remains scale invariant for all values of n. So it is possible. So what really makes this difference could be the monopoles operator becoming relevant near the critical point, because non-compact QED still remains scale invariant. That means that the Fermi operator and so on are still remaining irrelevant at this point. So the only operator that could become relevant is the monopole operator. And studying, so you can turn it around and ask what happens to the scaling dimensions of monopole operators at the infrared fixed point of non-compact QED. So you apply the same method. So this is the free energy of the monopole, anti-monopole background field as a function of the box size in QED. And the different colors here correspond to n equals 2 QED, 4 QED, and blue one is a 12 QED. So 12 is large enough that you expect that it's a large enough value of n to use as a large n value would be true. And if you do fit it across this large enough value of L, you do see that it's nicely agrees with the large n expectation at these values. On the other hand, what's surprising is that if you lower the value of n, the slope here actually gets increases as a function of smaller value of n. And that's not expected from 1 by n expansion. Up to 1 by n expansion, you expect the slope to actually go down with 1 by n. And one way to easily see that is to plot this difference of free energy per flavor. So what I show here is the free energy per flavor for n equals 2 subtracted from n equals 12 free energy per flavor. So as you see, this difference actually shows a nicer logarithmic behavior compared to the free energy itself. The other thing to notice is that you see a pretty good signal of a positive slope here. The corresponding expectation in 1 by n expansion by Silviu Pufu and collaborators is that it's actually a negative slope. The slope itself is tiny, remember that. So it's a correction to 1 by n expansion is still leading order in 1 by n is still small, but the actual ab initio value is a positive small number, whereas the expectation from 1 by n is a negative small number. So if you ask questions like what is the value where the scale, where the monopole operator becomes marginally relevant, I don't think that value still remains around 12. But at a very fine level of what is the correction from large n value at smaller n, there are differences. So
can this be saved by a high order correction, or does this have to be that order one correction from
this one? Order n correction 1 by n is true, but it could either mean 1 by n expansion is breaking down, or there's a one, maybe you add a higher order, there's a larger positive 1 by n square correction. I mean, nobody has done that calculation, so I don't know. But if the self-duality of QED and it's actually a conformal in the infrared, that would mean that the n equals 2 QED or these lower values could be of a different class of CFTs compared to the large n itself, in which case I don't think 1 by n expansion might itself break down at smaller values of. And that's also another possibility. So let me just stop here. That's the question.
So we have time for one or two quick questions.
For the solution, get a cut phase, not the topological order. Is this feasible to see the latitude or not?
It's okay. I've told you how to realize the topological field theories. Is but you need some Chern-Simons term in your theory, right? Okay. For that, you need
for example, is the QED with charge 2, random monopole operator. You're going to get a gap phase.
But for that, you need to put it on some non-trivial manifold.
You can put the expectation value of this loop, and they should be deconfined.
Even on a torus.
Well, in a very large torus, I mean, you have deconfinement.
Okay. That is realizable. Anything on the torus is realizable right now. But anything that requires a Chern-Simons term, it's not. We know how to do the Chern-Simons on the lattice. But it suffers. Yeah. Okay. But if it's just torus, it's real. It's possible. But if you want to do some non-trivial topology, it's right now it's not.
Question is, even if that happens, how would you detect that?
Is it do the Wilson line?
It's not perimeter law. You would not be confined. It's like it's a gauge theory with matter field. What does perimeter? It's a gauge theory with matter field. What does perimeter law?
You have one from symmetry, which is spontaneously broken. So this is not screened by the matter.
So the theory is basically compact QED. Instead of F squared, I put a cos F term.
Sorry?
Instead of F squared term in the Maxwell term, I cos F.
The example is not a new one, but like as you do with one adjoint.
Okay.
Then for a finite range of the mass, we're going to get the material. The U1 case, the U1 with charge 2, and they form with a monopole, specific monopole, then you should put to the.
OK, I still don't know how to put a specific monopole. That's, I don't know. I just told you how to do the correlator, but I don't know how to put it in action. That's something I haven't figured it out yet.
Another question? If not, thank you.